Beautiful song from 1972, From the Beginning. Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. I thought the song would be a perfect segue to a new beginning for physics. Our next guest thinks we are on the cusp of a revolution of sorts, a paradigm shift, how humanity looks at reality. One of the perks of being associated with Coast to Coast is it opens doors that would otherwise be closed to me. As a journalist, I get invited to listen in, to eavesdrop on, or participate in a lot of discussions and debates that would really never be available to me. They're not available to the general public, for the most part, that is. One of those venues is an email list consisting of some of the finest minds in the world, deep thinkers, physicists, and philosophers, and they engage in these ongoing, knockdown, drag out, no holds barred debates about all sorts of esoteric points. It's kind of science at its best, the way it's supposed to work, sort of like instant peer review. And back and forth, these discussions rage. Mostly they stick to the high road, but sometimes they get down and dirty too. One such debate has been underway for the past few weeks. In fact, it's ongoing right now. I just saw a couple of emails during the break. It's still going on, which is how I came to know the name of our next guest. This email list is moderated by a maverick physicist named Dr. Jack Sarfatti, who has been my guest on this program. It also includes Dr. Quantum himself, aka Fred Alan Wolf, who's been on the show, Nobel laureate Dr. Brian Josephson, a famed author and philosopher Deepak Chopra, and our next guest, Dr. Ruth Kastner. For the past couple of weeks, Ruth has been going toe to toe, blow for blow against some of these big brain scientists. At issue is the nature of reality itself, questions about consciousness, what it is. Do we have free will? Which system of rules best explains how the universe really works? How quantum mechanics and relativity can coexist? How much of our reality is unseen, undetected? What is reality? What's it really like? What's real? The debate is at such a high level that it's pretty much tests the limits, the outer limits of my little noggin. Hard for a non-scientist to follow this stuff, and I'm not just saying that. As I have watched in awe as these mental heavyweights have gone back and forth, I knew it would be a great interest to Coast listeners if they could eavesdrop on some of this stuff, since it directly relates to many of the big questions that we grapple with week after week on this program. So I invited Dr. Ruth Kastner to join us to talk about her new book, Understanding Our Unseen Reality. She joins us in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, everyone. Ruth Kastner, PhD, is a faculty member in the School of Liberal Arts at Excelsior College. She received her MS in physics from the University of Maryland, then decided she was interested in the foundational aspects being studied by the philosophy department, and she got her PhD in philosophy of science. Her work is focused on elaborating and extending something that's called transactional interpretation of quantum mechanics. Basically, we're talking about a set of rules for sort of understanding how the universe, how cosmos, how reality actually works. And the title of her new book sort of capsulizes that, Understanding Our Unseen Reality, Solving Quantum Riddles. Ruth Kastner, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much, George.
I said, I don't know if you heard me in the introduction before, I wasn't exaggerating, is that I have tough time following the debate that you're engaged in with those other big brain folks online, but I've enjoyed it immensely. The same is true for your book. I mean, it is written for non-scientists, so it should not intimidate anybody who wants to check it out. You do a great job of boiling this stuff down to terms that the rest of us can understand. One of the reasons you go into journalism is so you don't have to do math. But I'll tell you, I've enjoyed every second of this and every second of your involvement in that debate that I mentioned. We'll get into that a little bit more.
Thank you. I'm glad.
Let's talk about you for a second. I read the background on that, how you got the master's in physics and then a doctorate in philosophy. Is that a normal sort of a path to take, or is that unusual?
It's probably unusual. I don't really know for sure, but my sense is that the people usually are interested in philosophy and they will just major in philosophy. So I don't really know of anyone else who followed that path in my area that in the geographic area that I did it, although I do know of other philosophers of physics who have done. a similar thing. So it's not unheard of, but it's not really the usual way to do it.
I asked it because, you know, and as I see you debating these guys, and as some of it gets pretty heated, it seems like they're implying, well, you're not really one of us. You know, you're a philosopher. And I would think that the adding the philosophical element to it is a really nice mix. It gives you sort of a broader view of some of these big issues that are being discussed, sort of a more open-minded thing. You're not as tied to one version of reality. It's less dogmatic. Is that how it's worked out?
Well, I think so. And, you know, the funny thing is that physicists are, much as they would rather perhaps not think about it this way, they are asking philosophical questions. I mean, that is the core of the physics quest is, and certainly in Einstein's view, was the way he actually put it was to know God's thoughts. Now, you can't get a whole lot more metaphysical than that. So, and of course, the early physicists called themselves natural philosophers. So there's a very strong tradition in the field of physics to be asking very profound questions about the nature of reality, in a sense that you don't feel that you have to be limited by ideas such as, well, how can we really observe this? Is this a completely observable phenomenon? That is the aspect of physics in which you have to be careful to make sure that your theories are corroboratable by experiment and so on. That's a very important quality control on physics. But the other crucial part of it that I think gets overlooked is that it is deeply philosophical in the sense that it is asking questions about the fundamental nature of reality. And I think that physicists can get into trouble and go down perhaps false avenues if they don't recognize that they are applying certain assumptions, metaphysical assumptions about the nature of reality to their theorizing and to their investigations without even knowing that they have these assumptions. So really at bottom, we're dealing with philosophical questions, and the best way to I think, responsibly and scientifically do that is to try to become more aware of our philosophical preconceptions. And so that's why, in fact, that's one reason I went into philosophy, was that I began to see how modern physics really demands an awareness of those issues. If you're not aware of what your foundational conceptual assumptions are, then you're going to necessarily constrain your thinking. And that's why I ended up on the path that I'm on is partly because I began to question those conceptual patterns that we've fallen into in physics and to say that's what we need to be questioning right now.
How divided are the camps? I mean, is it, maybe I'm misreading it, but the physical guys who were just talking about atoms, things that we can measure, things we can touch, is that one group? And then the quantum folks, they see you as kind of the weirdos of the group and kind of the the dreamers, and they don't really consider you true scientists, or is it it's not as divided as that?
I don't think so. I wouldn't characterize it that way. There is at least one physicist in the group, Menas Kafatos, who, as far as I know, is a physicist by training, and he actually has some, I guess you would characterize them as more radical ideas than I do about the nature of consciousness and the role of consciousness in quantum theory. So I think there are primarily physicists on the list, but I don't see a clear division in that sense. I certainly don't feel as though any of the players have felt that I'm not really one of them because I'm primarily a philosopher. I think that there's more of a disagreement about those conceptual assumptions, whereas Jack has a very fond, you know, view of a particular interpretation, the so-called Bohmian interpretation, which has a certain metaphysical picture. He thinks that he likes that one the best, and he doesn't seem to like the one I'm proposing. So it's more a question of what kind of picture do we want to ascribe to reality. I see that it's more the nature of the disagreement.
There was one exchange some days ago that almost made me stop breathing. I just thought it was really so dramatic, made me think. It was Deepak Chopra said something to the effect that Science has brought us to the door of the unknowable, where measurement and verification by experiment do not apply. And I thought, wow, that's some pretty heavy stuff. That's not going to go over well with these physicist guys, that science can only take us so far, and there are things beyond those limits that science cannot explain. Do you believe that to be true?
Well, interestingly, you know, John Wheeler actually said something very much like that. I'm looking at the email exchanges here, and one of the players, Paul Zielinski, who does have some good training in philosophy of science, I believe he was quoting an excerpt from a writing from John Wheeler, who of course was a very prominent and well-respected physicist, who actually put it this way. Let me see if I can find this. Okay, let's see.
There's hundreds of pages of these exchanges,
yes,
by the way.
So. Okay, he says he's talking about the delayed choice experiment, but it talks about this quantum phenomenon that began, so I'm quoting now from John Wheeler, I believe, quantum phenomenon that began so long ago and stretches out unknown and unknowable like a great smoky dragon through the vast intervening reach of space and time has been brought to a close by an irreversible act of amplification, and so on, unquote. So he himself is using words like a great smoky dragon, unknown and unknowable, this mystical sort of language to describe the quantum realm. So this is where we are in quantum theory, where very prominent and very accomplished physicists are referring to it in these kinds of mystical terms. So it's really not Deepak Chopra who has suggested this. In fact, when you quoted what he said, he was actually kind of paraphrasing something that I've said, I believe, in my book or in talking to the gentleman here about my book, making the point that in my opinion, the triumph of physics and the fact that the evidence, in my opinion, of what a wonderfully sound mode of research it is that to its credit, empirical physics has brought us to the end of its own range. In other words, if you take physics as being a theory about the knowable world, the part of the world that we can test, that we can put to our theories to the test, physics has done such a great job that it's brought us to the very, very end of its ability to do its own job. Kind of like the way I put it, I think, in the emails, was that it's as if the student has surpassed the teacher. You know, sometimes you'll have a great teacher who's a great master of some instrument or some skill, and they'll have a student who is so good that the teacher will teach that student everything it possibly can, and yet the student will somehow strike out in a new direction based on that teacher's masterful teaching and find a whole new domain, a whole new area of knowledge that the teacher was not able to discover. So that's where I think we are. I think that quantum theory is that great teacher. Physics is that great teacher that has brought us to the outermost realm of what it can teach us. And we have to use philosophical and rational methods now to try to understand what these theories are saying to us, even though those ideas may not be testable. That's the frustrating part, is that we have to kind of interpret, we have to figure out what's the best, cleanest, most rational, and most revealing and fruitful way to understand what this theory is telling us about reality, even though we may not ever be able to test that new knowledge.
Help sort of set the stage for the rest of our discussion tonight. In a nutshell, give us sort of the classical physics view of reality, juxtaposed against sort of the quantum mechanics view. I mean, Einstein, relativity, we all kind of have a general understanding of that. How it's at odds, and then later we'll get into whether those two versions of reality can coexist.
Okay. Well, the classical physics that has been so successful and kind of took us up to the end of the 20th century, basically, was an idea, a view of nature in which everything was kind of mechanical, and so that you could sort of build models of things, and you could lay them out in a very visualizable way, so you could visualize everything, you could draw pictures of it, pictures in your ordinary 3D world that you could clearly see, and you could say, okay, I see this happening, and I see this is going around that. And so it was just very mechanistic and very kind of nuts and bolts. Let's take things apart and see how they work. You know, there's no mysteries. There's nothing that we can't take apart and reduce it to some inner workings that we also can analyze and see what those inner workings are doing, much like a clock or a watch. And the other idea that went along with that was that we can have very precise laws that describe the workings of these mechanistic systems, so that if we can say something about how everything started out, we can say where are all the parts and what are their initial states of motion, and we can plug that information into our laws, and what will turn out is exactly what everything's going to do until the foreseeable distant future. So we would clearly be able to spell out, given our initial information, everything about the evolution of that system. So that's basically the classical view, and it was very successful and very satisfying because it was very powerful. Of course, that's the theory we use to send people to the moon and, you know, spacecraft out into the solar system. They're very good laws, and they work very well. But quantum mechanics is a very different thing. Did you have any question, or should
no,
I?
No, we got about 3 minutes, and we're going to go to a break. But I mean, maybe the way to characterize it is that the relativity, the classical physics works on the macro level, explains why how planets operate in gravity and that macro scale. But it doesn't work so well for the micro scale, right? It doesn't work for atoms and things like that.
Right. Yes, that's where we had toward the end of the 19th century, we had that state where physicists were feeling very good about themselves, but there were those little clouds on the horizon, and they thought they just had a few more details to hammer out. But then when they started looking at the tiniest, the smallest constituents of matter, they really ran into some big problems. And the atom, understanding how the atom worked, was one of those very big problems. And to put it sort of as briefly as possible, the biggest, most obvious problem was that if you applied those classical macroscopic laws of electromagnetism to what was going on in the atom, which kind of people thought was a little group of charges, a positively charged nucleus and negatively charged electrons kind of orbiting around the nucleus, that if you applied the classical electromagnetic theory to those orbiting electrons, that theory said they were going to lose energy, radiate away, and just crash into the nucleus of the atom. So the big problem for that classical physics was it did not sustain atoms. And atoms are supposed to be the fundamental, very stable building blocks of matter, which in fact we know that they are very stable. But the classical theory just utterly failed to describe that.
And in the current state, I mean, it's not either or. You don't have to choose between classical physics or quantum mechanics. The real debate or the real battleground is figuring out how the two can coexist, right?
Exactly, right. We need them both. And we certainly know that from the great success of quantum theory that it does work to describe the behavior of these tiny constituents of matter. And we do know that our classical laws work very well to describe, you know, how to send a satellite out there and do the things we do in outer space. So how do we reconcile those two? And I would like to propose, and in my book, what I'm proposing is an idea that does reconcile those two types of theories.
There's a famous quote from Einstein where he says, "God does not play dice with the universe." I never really understood what the heck he was talking about until I read your book. Can you share? I think we're going to go to a break here now, so maybe there's not time for that, but we'll get into that after the break. And then how this relates to people in our audience is understanding the nature of reality itself, understanding consciousness, because as you explain in your book, I mean, quantum mechanics and quantum theory does give you a pretty good handle on understanding what those things are, what their limits are, and what they mean. We'll continue our conversation with Dr. Ruth Kastner about her book, Understanding Our Unseen Reality, right after this on Coast to Coast AM. philosophical musings from an old soul there, George Harrison, his landmark All Things Must Pass from 1970. I suppose you can make an argument about that, whether all things must pass. Energy, for example, doesn't really disappear. It's one of the points, arguments that's made in Ruth Kastner's book, Understanding Our Unseen Reality. When we come back, we get into the nature of reality, what's real and what isn't, and what's the best way to measure it. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Ruth Kastner. I mentioned at the beginning of this program, the very beginning, Ruth, that we cover some pretty strange stuff on Coast to Coast from time to time, mysteries and enigmas. But I don't think that Coast to Coast can hold a candle to quantum mechanics. Reading your book and some of the stuff you delve into, it gets flat out weird. You use two tools to sort of bring it back down to earth and help people understand what you're talking about. There are two stories that you tell. One is about the iceberg, which you mentioned in your book, and two is Plato's cave. Maybe it's a good place to sort of tell those stories now to give our audience a framework as we move forward.
Okay. Well, the iceberg picture that I use involves trying to communicate the place that space-time has in our picture of reality. To understand that, I guess if your listeners can kind of just pretend that they're on an ocean-going vessel, hopefully not the Titanic, but some ocean-going vessel that's a little more savvy about avoiding icebergs, and your captain says, "Oh, everyone on deck, get out your binoculars. You see that mountain of ice way off in the distance? Well, that is an iceberg, and don't worry, we're not going to do what the Titanic did. We're not going to go up and take a closer look. We're going to stay far away, but look through your binoculars, and you'll get a look at the tip of that iceberg." So everyone does that, and they can see this fairly large mountain of ice just kind of jutting up above the water. But then, of course, by now most of us know that when you look at an iceberg that way, the whole thing that makes it dangerous is that there's a huge amount of that iceberg hidden below the water that actually extends way beyond just that tip that you're seeing. And this picture is what I use to explain what I think and what I think this interpretation is telling us about reality and what quantum theory is telling us about reality, that in fact that tip of the iceberg is what we call our space-time world, which most physicists, and including myself when I first started out, assume that that is the entirety of physical reality. And certainly I think that's what Einstein thought, and that seems like a natural assumption that space-time is where we live. It's where everything lives, and all physical activities and processes and objects live in space-time. And it seems crazy to think, well, maybe there's something beyond that. But in fact, what I think quantum theory is telling us is that space-time is really just the tip of that iceberg, and that quantum physics is describing that huge submerged portion of the iceberg, so that there's actually a huge part of reality that is hidden beneath the surface, and that is why it's so hard to get at it and so hard to describe it in terms that you can picture, but that the theory is very stubbornly telling us that we can't ignore it, that it's really there, and that it's not just some imaginary, abstract, hypothetical, or informational concept. It's actually a physical realm that is necessary to understand how space-time itself comes about. So that's the iceberg picture. And then, now remind me, what was the other one?
Plato's Parable of the Cave.
Okay, so yeah, Plato's Cave. So yeah, good old Plato, had this sense, even way back when he was doing his investigations of reality, had this sense or this intuition that the world of appearance around us is not the whole story. And that's very similar to this whole story about the iceberg, that in those terms of that Plato was calling his world of appearance is what we would call the space-time realm, the realm of observable phenomena. And the idea of Plato's cave is this little allegory he tells where it's as if there's this very dark cave and there are prisoners who are chained in this cave so that they are always facing this dark wall. but at the mouth of the cave behind them is some bright light. And people are kind of marching in and out behind these prisoners carrying various objects. And the light that shines through that mouth of the cave is casting shadows of those objects onto the wall that these prisoners are gazing on. And they see these moving shadows and they go, okay, well, we're so bored in here in this dark cave, you know, at least we've got something to watch. We've got this shadow play. Okay, let's analyze this. Let's study this. There's stuff going on there, these shadows on the wall. And they get very good at analyzing them and studying them, and they think they figured them out, and they think they completely understand them. But, of course, the story is telling us that behind them there's actually a much more vivid and substantial and robust reality that is these objects that clearly are a lot more than the shadows that the prisoners are seeing. So the story, again, is one where our ordinary way of picturing reality, we're sort of like these prisoners that are only seeing a small portion, a kind of a projection of this larger reality that is these objects being carried around behind them. That if they could only turn around and look at them and have a different perspective, they would see that the phenomena they're watching is not the whole story of what's actually going on.
So the world as we know it really is just a tiny piece of what's really out there.
That's what the theory seems to be telling us, that we are really kind of looking at the tip of the iceberg, and certainly there's a lot of that we can study and learn about and measure, but that's classical physics. And if you want to learn more, if you know, once people started kind of deciding to look at the very bottom of the tip of the iceberg, so to speak, and understand more about it, they found that they had to use this different theory that was starting to tell them about an aspect of reality that they really need a different kind of conceptual toolbox to really understand it.
Well, it seems like, you know, when you read bits and pieces of Einstein, and I haven't read a whole lot of that stuff, but the quote that I mentioned before, God does not play dice with the universe, it almost feels like he was chafing at this. He sort of resisted the ideas of quantum mechanics, or reluctantly embraced it eventually.
Well, yes, he did. You know, he really thought that you should be able to give a complete picturable account of reality. And of course, that's one of the great conflicts that he had with Bohr and Heisenberg. And we often think, wow, you know, how could, if Einstein, you know, couldn't get this, well, you know, what's going on? Because he was such a brilliant genius. But the whole idea, of course, there's still controversy about this. There are a lot of people out there who think that, well, Einstein was right. There's no playing dice. I mean, the idea, the reference to playing dice with the universe is a reference to the aspect of quantum theory in which it does not seem to give us a clear single answer about what an object is going to do. What if we can sort of, unlike in classical physics where we can plug in all of that initial information we have about an object and we can map out all its future behavior, quantum theory in general won't let you do that. It'll just give you a sort of a bunch of different possible outcomes or possible trails, that paths that the object is going to take, and it won't tell you which one. And there are ways to get around this, and some interpreters try to get around this by so-called hidden variables. And this is one thing that Einstein was trying to do. He was trying to kind of say, rather than have this submerged portion of the iceberg, so to speak, I think we can explain everything by saying that everything does have a place on the tip of the iceberg, to kind of use that metaphor. I happen to think that's not the best way to go. It kind of reminds me of an earlier scientific revolution, the switch from thinking that everything revolved around the Earth to the sun-centered picture that we now think is right. We now recognize to be the better story of the solar system, all the bodies in the solar system revolving around the sun rather than everything going around the Earth. But for a long time, people wanted to hold on to that picture, because if you think about it, I mean, our ordinary experiences, we certainly see the sun that going around us. I mean, it sure looks like stuff is going around the Earth. So you have to kind of question your own observations. And a lot of people didn't want to do that. And one famous ancient astronomer, Ptolemy, did a good job of kind of coming up with an alternative theory that kept everything going around the Earth, but it was very complicated. You had to have these epicycles, and you had to have things doing, you know, the planets kind of going, reversing their motion and doing very strange, complicated things in order to preserve the phenomena that we were seeing. And I tend to view these attempts to keep everything in space-time, keep everything sort of not a game of dice, so to speak, as that kind of approach, trying to hold on to that earlier classical picture in a way that I think makes things more cumbersome and more complicated.
Sticking with your iceberg analogy, the concept that there's a whole lot of reality that we never see, an unseen realm, are you referencing dark matter, dark energy? I mean, that's something that our audience members would read. You know, their articles appear in the newspaper about scientists struggling to explain where's all the dark matter and dark energy we've been hearing about for so long. Or is it something else?
I'm actually not talking about that. It may turn out that those quantities may have something to do with quantum reality. But even if there were no need for dark matter and dark energy, we would still have quantum theory describing those tiny constituents of matter, and we would still have that same dilemma of the very nature of the theory seems to describe objects that really can't fit into space-time. So yeah, this is really a separate issue from the dark matter and dark energy.
I don't want to jump too far ahead, but at the end of the book, you're talking about us being on the cusp of new discoveries, a new paradigm, a new understanding of reality. Will we have to be dragged kicking and screaming into that?
Well, I hope not. What strikes me as interesting is that one of the attempts to understand quantum theory is the very famous many worlds interpretation that people
yes.
seem to really like, and they really embrace that. And you've seen all the Star Trek episode with Worf coming back, I don't want to go into, I'm a geek here, but Worf goes and has...
Hey, you're among friends.
...parallel worlds. Sorry?
You're among friends. Go right ahead.
Oh, good.
Geek it up.
I think it's a Deep Space Nine episode where they actually do employ this many worlds picture, and they have, maybe this was Next Generation. Anyway, they have, the Enterprise... encountering all kinds of different experiences in many, many different worlds. So if you're okay with that, you should really be okay with the idea that there are possibilities out there, that instead of many actual worlds, and there are many reasons why I don't think that really works, and the researchers are starting to realize, I think, that the many worlds interpretation has some very serious problems that make it really not quite work to solve the problems that it's supposed to solve. But instead of that, if you're willing to entertain the idea that we've got many worlds side by side, that we certainly can't, you and I in this particular world can't experience the other worlds, and allegedly we have our counterparts doing something different in all these many other worlds. If you're okay with that, then it's actually less radical to say, actually, there's one phenomenal world in space-time, but there are many possibilities. And that's what quantum mechanics is describing. There are just many, if you will, unmanifest possibilities, but they're real. And the fact that they are real means that maybe we can tune into them and make use of them in some way. So they're really there, and there's really a lot of them. But just like those many worlds and the many worlds interpretation, we don't directly observe them. We can't kind of look at them all in a laboratory and say, "Hey, are you seeing that?" We're all looking at it. That's one thing we can't do with them, but that we can indirectly know about their existence.
Well, before we leave the multiverse idea, tell me what the problem is about it, because I thought that was sort of the direction that science, at least for a few years, was heading. Is that supported by the classical physics guys or the quantum, or neither?
Well, it's supported by a lot of physicists who deal with quantum theory and who think that, this gets a little bit technical, but they want to avoid the idea of wave function collapse. So basically, it was invented by this guy, Hugh Everett III, back right. in 1957, I believe, and he wrote his PhD dissertation on the idea that if you just have the what's called unitary Schrodinger equation evolution of the quantum wave function, and you pretend, you just assume there's never any collapse, a I think a lot of your listeners have probably heard of wave function collapse. Well, the many worlds approach denies that, and it says there's never any collapse. And all the possible outcomes of the wave function all happen, but they all happen in different worlds. And that's the idea. But the big problem with it is that you need to be able to say, and this gets a little technical too, but when you measure things, you measure particular observables. And some observables, pairs of observables, are not compatible with each other. So you have to decide, for instance, whether you're going to measure position or momentum, or whether you're going to measure a particular spin direction versus some other spin direction. And you can never do those measurements at the same time. They're incompatible. And you have to pick one of these observables, and you have to be able to say, why is the universe splitting with respect to the different ways that this observable could come out, the different outcomes for this particular observable as opposed to some other observable? It's called the basis problem. And you need to have a well-defined basis, basis just meaning a technical term for what observable am I measuring. You need to have a well-defined observable in order to say how your universe is splitting. And you can't do that. There's no principled way to do that. Because you, in order to do it, you kind of have to say, I already have things like measuring devices and experimenters, and we can talk about what they're measuring. But that's what you're supposed to be able to explain. That's what you're supposed to be explaining through your many worlds interpretation. So it just doesn't really get off the ground. And I know my explanation is probably not going to be satisfying at this level, but I do have a blog post on that that kind of gives some diagrams and tries to explain basically why that just doesn't work.
Well, it's not satisfying because I wanted it to be true. That's why. I mean, I'd like to believe that.
It's a fun story, but it just doesn't really work. And I think people are starting to realize that.
What was amazing to me is
in many worlds you could have many possibilities, and that's much more fruitful, I think.
Yeah, I like the idea that a version of me somewhere joined the Beatles and is writing hit songs, or I had another version where I had an island or something like that, and but I'm stuck with me.
You can do whatever you want because you've got all those possibilities to work with.
I was amazed in reading your exchanges with these other guys on the email list that someone has worked out equations for trying to compute how many other worlds there really would be.
Well, you know, they may be talking about other aspects of this so-called multiverse picture, which deals with other issues such as, well, are there other possible worlds that have different values of the physical constants? And there are other cosmologically based reasons for wanting to talk about other possible universes. That is actually, those are separate issues from the quantum, you know, the simple quantum theory issue of how to interpret quantum theory. There are many different layers to this multiverse idea. I happen to not agree with it. I think there's probably one world, but I certainly can't rule it out.
And about higher dimensions, maybe we're going to go to a break in about a minute, so we're not going to have time to deal with that. But I want to cover the idea of higher dimensions. You do touch on that here or there. And I think for Coast to Coast listeners, the central question would be, if there are other worlds, other dimensions, are there people there? And whether or not we can ever communicate with them in some way.
But, well, no, in this picture, people are sort of tip of the iceberg things in terms of our physical bodies. So, but you can feel good about that. You are unique. You are you. And a lot of hidden possibilities, according to this picture, go into bringing you into existence. And so you are kind of, as that person on the tip of the iceberg, you can be king of the hill, so to speak. You know, there's a lot that goes into you and your makeup and the actions that you take.
Oh, I definitely want to hear more about that in the next segment here. We're talking with Dr. Ruth Kastner about understanding our unseen reality, and Van Morrison takes us into the mystic.